watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Why should we strive to get to the truth about 9/11? For some people, the answer is already obvious. For others, including some of the people I most admire or love, it is not. Some say we'll never know the truth, and people are wasting energy that could be applied to the many pressing problems in the world about which there is no doubt. But I think that 9/11 and its aftermath furthered the very things that underlie a wide range of problems we face. If one believes the government version, then it is reasonable to pursue abridgment of rights and military actions as a matter of self-defense, or so we're told. But if 9/11 is an inside job, then it is a project to consolidate the power of what I'll call the military-industrial complex, for short, in its quest for empire, for corporate domination, and for abridgment of popular rule and liberties under law. Since 9/11, it has made all those necessary struggles more difficult in the U.S. and elsewhere. As, for example, the environmentalists that have recently received long jail sentences under new anti-terrorism laws. It is my view that the opponents of corporate rule and other domestic dissidents were always the targets of those laws. But if the people pushing the repressive laws are also the perpetrators of the attack, then we have quite a different picture. Many who don't question the official story of 9/11 do not because, knowing the violence and misery the U.S. imperial project has caused all over the world, they point to 9/11 as a form of inevitable retaliation and note that it is surprising that this doesn't happen far more often. Why doesn't it? Perhaps because of the vast military and intelligence apparatus of the empire, which has taken a great deal of effort to defend itself against reprisals from its victims, yet which somehow, spectacularly, was so inept on this occasion. 9/11-type events create a political climate which furthers imperial aggression and repression under cover of necessary defense. This militarism then and now would not be possible without the active participation or at least the passive acquiescence of the American people, and a system of propaganda, lies, and deception that has been established in America, perpetuated through our schools and media, to create a baffled, self-absorbed, atomized population which can be easily misdirected, distracted, and controlled, immobilized in the matrix. This edifice has been increased and strengthened on the shoulders of 9/11. The successor justification brought into the gap left by the end of the Cold War. Put forward under claims of national defense that were really profit opportunity protection. And even now, the truth about past deceptions by the government is not known by the vast majority of people, thanks to our intentionally lousy education and media system. Far too many people have already died for the present lie, and more will die the longer it goes unexposed. I have no doubt that it is a lie, and I believe exposing it in a timely manner can make the space for essential systemic change. On the other hand, to let the present trend run its course is to create a world not worth living in, if it is possible to live in it at all. Our speaker this week, David Ray Griffin, Professor Emeritus of Theology and Philosophy from Claremont College and author of many books challenging the government version of 9/11, has pursued this matter for many of the same reasons. He spoke on May 16th in Vancouver, B.C. about his new book, Debunking 9/11 Debunking, at an event sponsored by the Vancouver 9/11 Truth Society. I want to thank this society, and especially Drew Noftley, who has, as have others in this movement, changed his whole life to take on the work of exposing the lies. The talk will take the entire program, so the next installment of John Taylor Gatto is on hiatus this week. I hope you won't be disappointed.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming, all of you. My name is Dave Duguay. I'm a proud member of the Vancouver 9/11 Truth Society, which is comprised of some of the very best people I've ever known. They're very hardworking, very dedicated, and very courageous, so I'm very pleased to be a member of that. I'm also a very proud Canadian for a number of reasons, not least of which is that we, as a society, say that we value honesty, integrity, and we have the courage to defend freedom when we need to. So I'm very proud, as a Canadian especially, to see everyone here today and for all the support that we've received, not just from everybody here, but also from the media and all across Canada. We have produced some of the very best voices in the 9/11 truth movement, from Michelle Chosadovsky to Ian Woods, and of course Barry Zwicker, and also Ms. Connie Fogle, who is a Vancouver resident, who heads up the Canadian Action Party, the only political party so far that has decided that they want to make it public that there is a need for a new 9/11 investigation. So, lots of reasons to be proud to be Canadian today. Dr. David Ray Griffin had a prolific and very lengthy career as a theologian. He was a year and a half away from retiring from that, a very celebrated career, when, as many of us have experienced, a friend of his told him to reanalyze the official story and the holes therein. And when he did that, he discovered that there are omissions and distortions off the official record that completely challenge the entire basis for the years now of aggressive wars that have been waged and the curtailment of civil liberties that we all know so well now. But what makes him a hero to me is that not only did he have the information, but he decided to do something about it. And he has written what many consider to be the seminal volumes on 9/11, including the New Pearl Harbor. And these books have used his scholarly knowledge to put aside speculation and rumor and replace it with logic, reason, and a chance for accountability, finally. So that is why he is a hero to me. He also represents to millions of people around the world that there is a chance for honest people of every country to band together and reanalyze what 9/11 means to them. Now we know the information is that what we have been given is flawed, but what are we going to do about it? I'd like to close before I bring him on with a review of his latest book, Debunking 9/11 Debunking, by famed historian and activist Howard Zinn. Considering how the 9/11 tragedy has been used by the Bush administration to propel us into immoral wars again and again, I believe that David Ray Griffin's provocative questions about 9/11 deserve to be investigated and addressed. So on that note, please join me in giving a warm Vancouver welcome to a true patriot and American hero, Dr. David Ray Griffin.
Thank you. Good evening. I'm very glad to be back in my favorite city. Some years back, there was a popular song called Let's Get Physical. Given my philosophical proclivities, a friend gave me a button that I used to wear to parties as a conversation starter called Let's Get Metaphysical. But now I have a new plea. Let's get empirical. And that's the title of my lecture tonight, 9/11, Let's Get Empirical. The reason I make this plea is explained at the outset of my most recent book, Debunking 9/11, Debunking, An Answer to Popular Mechanics and Other Defenders of the Official Conspiracy Theory. I begin by saying the evidence that 9/11 was an inside job is overwhelming. Most people who examine it with an open mind find it convincing. The only problem is getting people, journalists particularly, to examine this evidence. Most of them believe they need not do so because they already know that our claim that 9/11 was an inside job is false. As a result, many journalists, whether writing for the New York Times or the Guardian or the Progressive or the Nation, have pontificated about 9/11 while knowing virtually nothing about the relevant facts. Although the question about what happened on 9/11 can only be answered responsibly on the basis of knowledge of these facts, many journalists, like many other people, have used various means to avoid examining those facts. One way to avoid getting empirical about 9/11 relies on an ambiguity in the term conspiracy theory. There are two main theories about what happened on 9/11. According to the government's theory, the attacks were carried out by Arab Muslim members of Al-Qaeda under the inspiration of Osama bin Laden. According to the 9/11 Truth Movement, the attacks were orchestrated or at least assisted by forces within the American government. Many people, including many journalists, assume that the 9/11 Truth Movement's theory can be dismissed a priori because it is a conspiracy theory. But a conspiracy, says my dictionary, is an agreement to perform together an illegal, treacherous, or evil act. To hold a conspiracy theory about some event, therefore, is simply to believe that that event rose out of some such agreement. This is, we can say, the generic meaning of the term conspiracy theory. Given this generic meaning, we are conspiracy theorists if we believe that individuals have conspired to rob banks, that oil companies have conspired with scientists for hire to conceal the reality of human-caused global warming, or that U.S. presidents have conspired with members of their administration to fabricate false pretexts for going to war. In other words, once we get empirical about the term conspiracy theory, we realize that we're all conspiracy theorists. Announcing that one rejects conspiracy theories is almost a reflex action in our culture. But we would be much more honest if we, with Michael Moore, would say, "Now, I'm not into conspiracy theories, except the ones that are true." In spite of the obviousness of this point, many journalists follow propagandists in using the term conspiracy theory as an accusation. We can call this the propagandistic meaning of the term. Those who use the term in this way ignore its generic meaning and simply equate conspiracy theories as such with conspiracy theories of a particular type, those that are irrational, unscientific, kooky, loopy. There are certainly plenty of conspiracy theories of this type. But given the fact that our newspapers and news programs contain reports of new conspiracies almost every day, it is dishonest, it is pure propaganda, to imply that all conspiracy theories are unworthy of belief. Those who use the term in this way against the 9/11 Truth Movement fail to point out that the government's theory, which they endorse, is equally a conspiracy theory. The only difference between the two theories involves the question of who the conspirators were. For example, Jim Dwyer of the New York Times wrote a story entitled, Two U.S. Reports Seek to Counter Conspiracy Theories About 9/11. A more accurate title would have been, Two U.S. Reports Say Government's Conspiracy Theory is Better Than Alternative Conspiracy Theory. In an essay entitled, Enough of the 9/11 Conspiracy Theories Already, Matthew Rothschild of the Progressive said, Here's what the conspiracist believes. 9/11 was an inside job. Members of the Bush administration ordered it, not Osama bin Laden. Arab hijackers may not have done the deed. The Twin Towers fell not because of the impact of the airplanes and the ensuing fires, but because of explosives. I'm amazed at how many people give credence to those theories. Rothschild did not have a paragraph saying, Here's what the government's conspiracists believe. 19 hijackers with knives and box cutters defeated the most sophisticated defense system in history. Hani Hanjour, who could barely fly a Piper Cub, flew an astounding trajectory to crash Flight 77 into the Pentagon, the most well-protected building on the planet. Other hijacker pilots, by flying planes into two buildings of the World Trade Center, caused three of them to collapse straight down, totally, and at virtually free-fall speed. I'm amazed at how many people give credence to those theories. He didn't say that. Nobody has said that in the mainstream or much of the left-leaning press. A senior editor for In These Times, writing about his experience in 2005 of seeing my C-SPAN lecture, 9/11 and American Empire, wrote that, having always thought highly of Griffin, it was shocking to see him pushing a radical conspiracy theory about 9/11 on C-SPAN. What could have transformed this sober, reflective scholar into a conspiracy theorist? The truth, of course, was that I had been a conspiracy theorist all along. All I did was change from the government's conspiracy theory to the alternative conspiracy theory. Moreover, what none of these writers would dare to think, or at least print, is that I switched to the alternative theory because I had finally gotten empirical. I had gone from knowing virtually nothing about the relevant facts to knowing quite a few of those facts. Once it is realized that both of the major theories about 9/11 are conspiracy theories, we can see that we must evaluate the two theories in terms of how well they take account of the relevant facts. We must get empirical. But, it might be thought, we need not spend our time studying these facts, all those tiresome details about standard procedures, timelines, the maximum temperature of office building fires, the melting point of steel, the testimonies of people at the World Trade Center, and so on. Because we can know a priori that the alternative theory, according to which 9/11 was orchestrated or at least assisted by the Bush administration, is false. We can know this because we can know that the Bush administration would not deliberately kill some 3,000 of its own citizens. However, if we get empirical about this a priori assumption, we can see that it is falsified by other facts that we know about this administration. One such fact is that the Bush-Cheney administration lied us into the war in Iraq. This was shown beyond doubt by a Downing Street memo, which reported, on the basis of a meeting with CIA Director George Tenet, that the intelligence and facts about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq were going to be fixed around the policy of going to war. The Americans who have died in Iraq because of the administration's lies now outnumber those who died on 9/11. Another example. After 9/11, the air at the site of the World Trade Center was extremely toxic, containing many times the safe levels of asbestos and other particles known to cause cancer and various lung diseases. Although this was known, the White House ordered the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, to lie, to tell the people that the air is safe to breathe. The EPA followed this order. As a result, many of the 40,000 rescue and cleanup workers wore no protective gear. Many thousands of these workers already have debilitating illnesses. About 100 have already died from cancer, And cancer is usually a slowly developing disease. So people who know about these things predict that more people will die in the next 10 to 15 years from breathing this air than died on 9/11. We have no a priori grounds, therefore, to believe that the Bush administration was too morally sensitive to have orchestrated 9/11. Let us look at a second common a priori reason often given for dismissing the possibility that 9/11 might have been an inside job. The claim that so many people would have been involved that someone would have talked by now. The general assumption here is that big government operations, at least in America, cannot be kept secret. However, the Manhattan Project to build the atomic bomb involved over 100,000 workers. Yet it was kept so secret that even Vice President Harry Truman did not learn about it until he became president. Another example, in 1957, the United States provoked and participated in a civil war in Indonesia that resulted in some 40,000 deaths. This illegal war was kept secret from the American people until a book appeared about it in 1995. Secrets can be kept, especially when those who know the secrets are likely to lose their jobs or even go to jail. And if that prospect is not sufficient, there are other well-known means to keep people from talking. Furthermore, people involved in criminal conspiracies generally talk only in the context of an investigation, when telling the truth is the only way to save their own skins. So given the fact that there has been no real investigation of 9/11, let alone a criminal investigation, the fact that no one has talked thus far cannot be used to justify ignoring the relevant evidence. There is, however, still another reason why many journalists believe they need not examine the facts about 9/11 for themselves. They think they should rely on the official reports about 9/11 that have been put out by the 9/11 Commission and the National Institute of Standards and Technology, along with some semi-official accounts, such as the book Debunking 9/11 Myths, put out by Popular Mechanics. The assumption behind this belief is that these are neutral organizations, providing strictly scientific evaluations of the evidence. Nothing could be further from the truth. The 9/11 Commission was run by Philip Zelikow, who was virtually a member of the Bush administration. Indeed, he was even brought in by his close friend and former co-author, Condoleezza Rice, to write the 2002 version of the National Security Strategy of the United States, an extremely bellicose neocon document that used 9/11 as a basis for adopting a new doctrine of preventive, preemptive warfare. Was a Zelikow-run commission likely to reveal evidence that 9/11 was an inside job? The National Institute of Standards and Technology, generally known simply as NIST, is an agency of the Commerce Department and hence presently an agency of the Bush-Cheney administration, an administration that has become notorious for distorting science to support its policies. Indeed, over 11,000 scientists, including 52 Nobel Prize winners, have endorsed a statement accusing the Bush administration of engaging in distortion of scientific knowledge for partisan political ends. Can we assume a priori that scientists writing a report about the destruction of the World Trade Center would not, if instructed to do so, distort the facts? The semi-official status of the Popular Mechanics book is demonstrated by the fact that it has been endorsed by Condoleezza Rice's State Department as providing excellent material debunking 9/11 conspiracy theories. Popular Mechanics says of itself that it was ideally equipped to research the evidence about 9/11 because of its more than 100 years of expertise in science and technology. However, just before the magazine began working on 9/11, the president of Hearst Magazines, Kathleen Black, who is married to a former CIA and Department of Defense official, replaced much of the staff, including the longtime creative director and the editor-in-chief. Moreover, one of the new members of the staff, who described himself as the senior researcher for the magazine's 2005 article about 9/11, on which its 2006 book was based, was Benjamin Chertoff, a cousin of the head of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff. Although Benjamin's mother confirmed that the two men were cousins, when she was asked, she said, "Of course, they're cousins." James Meigs, the new editor-in-chief, has tried to cast doubt on this connection. He speaks of the odd coincidence that the two men have the same last name. And he allows that it's possible that Ben and Michael are distantly related. This is one of the unintentionally hilarious moments in the book. Although Meigs claimed that he and his crack staff were able, in a few months, to discover all the central truths about 9/11, why the hijacked airliners were not intercepted, why the World Trade Center buildings came down, what really hit the Pentagon, and what really happened to United Airlines Flight 93. They could not discover whether a member of their own team was related to the director of Homeland Security. The moral of this discussion, in any case, is that none of these official or semi-official reports can be assumed to be the unvarnished truth about 9/11 or anything close to it. However, many journalists, treating these reports as if they were authoritative, have been led to absurd conclusions. For example, Alexander Coburn accepts the 9/11 Commission's claim that the military failed to intercept the hijacked airliners because of incompetence, especially by the FAA. He then, on this basis, refers to members of the 9/11 truth movement as 9/11 conspiracy nuts. Members of this movement, Coburn charges, know no military history, have no grasp of the real world, no conception of evidence, and they represent the ascendancy of magic over reason. This charge might be possible as long as one knows nothing about the 9/11 movement, except that one of its spokespersons is a theologian. Coburn calls me the guru of the 9/11 conspiracy movement, as if it were a faith-based movement. If, however, one gets empirical about the 9/11 truth movement, one can quickly see that Coburn's characterization cannot even qualify as a caricature. The movement includes Colonel Robert Bowman, the head of Star Wars during the Ford and Carter administration, Andreas von Bülow, former state secretary in the German Federal Ministry of Defense, General Leonid Ivashov, former chief of staff of the Russian Armed Forces, Colonel Ronald D. Ray, a highly decorated Vietnam veteran who became deputy assistant secretary of defense during the Reagan administration, and many other former military officers, such as Lieutenant Colonel Guy Rezier, an Air Force fighter pilot who says, "After 4+ years of research since retirement in 2002, I am 100% convinced that the attacks of September 11, 2001, were planned, organized, and committed by treasonous perpetrators that have infiltrated the highest levels of our government." The movement also includes organizations called Pilots for 9/11 Truth, Veterans for 9/11 Truth, Scholars for 9/11 Truth, Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and SPINE, the scientific panel investigating 9/11. The movement also contains several former intelligence officers, including former CIA analysts Bill Christensen and Ray McGovern. The movement was also endorsed shortly before his death in 2006 by William Sloan Coffin, who had been a Russian specialist for the CIA before he became a well-known preacher and civil rights and anti-war activist. As this list makes clear, the 9/11 truth movement, if examined empirically, cannot be dismissed as a bunch of conspiracy nuts with no grasp of the real world and military affairs, as people who, having no conception of evidence, engage in magical thinking. Coburn's unempirical approach to the 9/11 movement, combined with his uncritical acceptance of official reports, has led him to make charges that are patently absurd. The moral of this discussion is that there is no a priori way to make a responsible judgment as to which of the two conspiracy theories about 9/11 is correct. We must look at the facts, then ask which theory better fits those facts. We must get empirical. At this point, defenders of the official story could say, "Exactly, and that's what we've done." Thomas Kane and Lee Hamilton, the chair and vice chair of the 9/11 Commission, put out a new book in 2006 entitled Without Precedent, The Inside Story of the 9/11 Commission. They write, "The starting point for the 9/11 Commission report was that it would focus on the facts. Indeed, Kane and Hamilton say, the term, go to the facts, became something of a joke within the commission. The real joke, however, is their claim that this is the method they actually used. The Popular Mechanics book is subtitled, Why Conspiracy Theories Cannot Stand Up to the Facts. The authors, in explaining their approach, say, we simply checked the facts. Not everyone who cries, Lord, Lord, Jesus of Nazareth reportedly said, really lives in accord with the will of God. Not everyone who cries, facts, facts, really follows the empirical method, letting their theories be determined by the facts rather than the other way around. Neither Popular Mechanics, nor NIST, nor the 9/11 Commission takes an empirical, scientific approach. They all begin with the official theory, then construe the facts to fit that theory, even though this requires distorting many facts and eliminating many others. It is, instead, the 9/11 truth movement that has gotten empirical about 9/11. I will give some examples. The whole basis for the Bush administration's attack on Afghanistan and its more general war on terror has been the claim that the attacks of 9/11 were carried out by Arab Muslim members of al-Qaeda under the leadership of Osama bin Laden. This claim, however, was never proven. Colin Powell, shortly after 9/11, promised to provide a white paper proving this, but it was never provided. The Taliban said that it would gladly turn over Osama bin Laden if the Bush administration would just give it some evidence that he was involved in 9/11. The Bush administration refused, leading a Taliban spokesman to say, we have asked for proof of Osama's involvement, but they have refused. Why? The 9/11 Commission, in spite of Kane and Hamilton's stated commitment to go to the facts, makes no mention of any of these facts. In claiming that they started with the facts, Kane and Hamilton say that their commission was not setting out to advocate one theory or interpretation of 9/11 versus another. And yet they tell us, when we set up the staff teams, we told one team to tell the story of al-Qaeda's most successful operation, the 9/11 attacks. They even told this team to approach their task as if putting together the case against the conspirators. If that is not starting with a theory, what would be? The 9/11 truth movement, by contrast, has gotten empirical about this matter. With regard to the alleged hijackers, there was, according to the government, much evidence that implicates them, such as video frames of them at airports, passports found at crash sites, and Mohammed Atta's luggage filled with incriminating evidence, luggage that didn't get put on Flight 11, we are told. The 9/11 truth movement, however, has pointed out that none of this evidence can withstand scrutiny. It contains absurdities such as a passport flying out of the first plane to strike the World Trade Center, and then floating safely to the ground, unsinged. Another passport and a red bandana jumped out of United Flight 93 after it, going 580 miles an hour, plummeted deep into the ground. But just at the last second, the cockpit opened and the passport and the red bandana flew out. Moreover, Mohammed Atta's luggage containing all this incriminating evidence also contained his will. If you were going to fly a plane into the World Trade Center, would you take your will? I'm not making this stuff up. Moreover, the 9/11 Commission, defending the official conspiracy theory, portrayed Atta and the others as devout Muslims, ready to meet their maker. But real truth seekers, getting empirical, have pointed out that Otta and several of the other alleged hijackers loved gambling, pork, alcohol, and lap dances. These facts were even reported by the Wall Street Journal. And yet the 9/11 Commission, in spite of its love for facts, said it had no idea why these men often went to Las Vegas. Another stunning discovery occurred when one member of the 9/11 Truth Movement decided to get empirical about an especially puzzling matter. The fact that the FBI's website on Osama bin Laden as a most wanted terrorist does not mention the 9/11 attacks as one of the attacks he's wanted for. Ed Haas, the founder of the Muckraker Report, contacted Rex Toom, chief of investigative publicity for the FBI, and asked why not. Toom replied, "The reason why 9/11 is not mentioned on Osama bin Laden's most wanted page is because the FBI has no hard evidence connecting bin Laden to 9/11. The 9/11 Commission could have made this discovery. Many months before the 9/11 Commission report appeared, the Family Steering Committee for the 9/11 Commission, comprised of relatives of the victims, asked the Commission to explain why bin Laden's profile on the FBI's Most Wanted Fugitive poster does not include the 9/11 attacks. However, the fact-loving 9/11 Commission, besides not answering this question, does not even reveal this fact to the American people when it published its report. Another essential element in the official conspiracy theory is that several passengers on the airliners made phone calls to loved ones that morning, reporting that their plane had been hijacked by foreigners. Some of these calls were reportedly made on seatback phones, and such calls were clearly possible. But cell phones were reportedly used for many of the calls, especially from United Flight 93, from which about 10 cell phone calls were reportedly made. These calls have been publicized by movies about this flight. There is, however, extremely strong evidence that these calls would not have been possible in 2001. Given the technology at that time, a cell phone had to get a signal from a cell site, and these signals were sent out horizontally, not vertically. There was, to be sure, some leakage, so that a cell phone on a low-flying small plane could get a good signal. But as the plane got higher, success became increasingly unlikely. Most anecdotal evidence indicated that the calls from small planes were impossible over 8,000 feet, and that calls from airliners with their much greater mass were generally impossible over 2,000 feet. This anecdotal evidence was in strong tension with the official story, according to which calls were made from airliners flying at 25 to 40,000 feet. Seeing this tension, Canadian computer scientist and mathematician Key Dudney, who had long written a column for Scientific American, decided to get empirical. Going up in a twin-engine airplane, he found that the success rate for the attempted cell phone calls decayed to zero by the time he reached 7,000 feet. Successful cell phone calls from airliners flying at 30,000 feet, he concluded, would have been flat out impossible. Dudney's conclusion was reinforced by the fact that in 2004, Qualcomm Incorporated announced with great fanfare that it had developed a new kind of technology in which a cellular base station on the plane, called a picocell, uses a satellite to transmit its calls. Passengers on the test flight, Qualcomm announced, were able to place and receive calls as if they were on the ground. American Airlines, which conducted the test flight, said that this new technology would become operative in 2006. The truth of Dudney's conclusion is also supported by a story in The Travel Technologist, published 1 week after 9/11, which said, "Wireless communication networks weren't designed for ground-to-air communication. Cellular experts privately admit that they're surprised the calls were able to be placed from the hijacked planes. They speculate that the only reason the calls went through in the first place is that the aircraft were flying so close to the ground." But the aircraft were not flying close to the ground. According to the 9/11 Commission itself, United 93 was at 34,300 feet when the passengers began making calls, then climbed to 40,700 feet. How do defenders of the official story handle this problem? During an interview in 2006, a well-informed Canadian journalist with the CBC, Evan Solomon, posed the following question to Lee Hamilton, the vice chair of the 9/11 Commission. If Flight 93 was flying well over 10,000 feet, 30,000, 40,000 feet, and yet cell phones won't work above 10,000 feet, how could people get on their cell phone on a plane and phone their relatives? Hamilton replied, I'm no expert on that. I've been told cell phones work sometimes above 10,000 feet and as high as 30,000 feet. So it may have been that some of the calls went through and some didn't. I just don't know. One problem with Hamilton's answer is that he had been asked about 40,000, not merely 30,000 feet. But the more serious problem is that although Hamilton was one of the leaders of the 9/11 Commission, which defended the official story, when challenged about one of the foundational pillars of that story, he said, I just don't know. Moreover, his statement that he had been told that cell phones work sometimes as high as 30,000 feet suggests that his 9/11 Commission had performed no experiments and had not even discussed this issue, although it had long been raised by critics of the official theory. This same lack of empirical curiosity permeates Popular Mechanics' treatment of the issue. Although its authors mention Dewdney's experiments, they try to debunk them by simply quoting recent interviews with two industry spokesmen who reportedly says that it was possible to make a call or at least get a signal at 35,000 feet. They cite no written evidence from 2001, and even though Popular Mechanics would have had the resources to carry out very extensive tests in order to try to refute Dewdney's conclusions, they carried out none. Or if they did, they didn't report the results. This kind of unempirical approach typifies their whole book, in spite of its subtitle, Why Conspiracy Theories Can't Stand Up to the Facts. Here's another interesting fact about the alleged phone calls. In the spring of 2006, at the same time moviegoers were watching United 93, the FBI, during the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui, reduced the claim about cell phone calls from this flight down to two, these perhaps being two calls allegedly made when the plane was at a lower altitude. So while Popular Mechanics was defending the government's claim that all the alleged cell phone calls from Flight 93 went through, the government was quietly withdrawing this claim. By the way, you can read this and many other fascinating facts about this flight, United 93, in the best book thus far written about this flight, which happens to be written by one of your neighbors, Roland Morgan, who lives not too far from here. And I believe he's here tonight. Roland, if you are, would you stand up so we can see you? There he is. Yes. So let me suggest you get his book, Flight 93 Revealed, and you will find a lot of revelations. What about the most well-known of the alleged phone calls? The one from Barbara Olson on American Flight 77 to her husband, Ted Olson, who was the U.S. Solicitor General, who has been a key figure in the Bush-Cheney administration. His testimony about this call has from the first contained inconsistencies, one of which involved the kind of phone she used. He first said it must have been an airplane phone. Then in another interview, he said it was a cell phone. Then he finally settled on it was a, he said she that calling collect, she used the phone in the passenger seats. By settling on this answer, his claim was no longer threatened by evidence that a cell phone call would have been impossible. But was even a call from a seatback phone possible? In my book, I said that it was not, because Flight 77 had no onboard phones. This was based on messages from American Airlines in 2004, saying that the Boeing 757s, made for American, unlike those made for United Airlines, had no onboard phones. But this may have been a mistake on my part. I may have falsely concluded that because American 757s did not have them in 2004, they didn't have them in 2001. People in the movement are still working on this issue, and the data are not in. We have another message that seems to be a genuine message from American, saying, that's right, there were no onboard phones, and so all the calls had to be made on cell phones. So stay tuned on that one. However, even if American 77s did have onboard phones, this fact would do little to overcome the implausibility of Ted Olson's report about Barbara Olson's calls. One problem is that she was the only person who reportedly used an onboard phone to make a call from that flight. And yet, she reportedly said that all the passengers and crew members had been herded to the back of the plane. Are we supposed to believe that none of the other people, seeing Barbara Olson making two phone calls, wouldn't have grabbed seatback phones to make calls of their own? Another problem is that the alleged hijackers were small men. She reportedly said that they were armed, but all she mentioned were knives and box cutters. Are we supposed to believe that these three or four small men who would have been in the cabin, one of them at least had to be flying the plane, could have not been easily overtaken by the 60-some passengers and crew, including the pilot, Charles Chip Burlingame, who was a tall, athletic man whose brother said they would have had to incapacitate him or kill him because he would have done anything to prevent the kind of tragedy that befell that plane. But she reportedly said both pilots were herded to the back of the plane. Still another problem has been pointed out by Roland Morgan, who has done sterling work on this issue, too. In an essay entitled Barbara Olson's Call from Flight 77 Never Happened, Morgan says, Ted Olson could shut up his critics by simply producing the Department of Justice's telephone accounts, showing a couple of hefty reverse charges entries charged from Flight 77's air phone number at around 7:20 a.m., on 11th September 2001. But such accounts have never been produced. By the way, I made a mistake in the book on this too, and both of these you can read about in an essay which you can find on Google called Barbara Olson's Alleged Calls from AA-77. I say the one may be a mistake or may not, but I definitely made a mistake on this one. The official story simply cannot handle the facts about cell phones or about Barbara Olson's alleged call. But how does the 9/11 Truth Movement handle the fact that so many relatives of passengers claimed that they received calls from these passengers? Do we have to charge that they're all lying or that they were all deluded? No. Although there was not the cell phone technology at that time to explain these flights, there was another kind of technology called voice morphing. It was already sufficiently perfected in 1999, as demonstrated by a test involving the voice of General Carl Steiner, who was quite well known. As a Washington Post story reported, General Steiner was heard to say, "Gentlemen, we have called you together to inform you that we are going to overthrow the United States government." Everybody in that room would have sworn that that was General Steiner. There is even a device that can fake the caller ID number. The technology was available, in other words, to fool the people who receive these calls, to make them think they were really hearing voices of their loved ones. Whether Ted Olson was a victim of this trickery or whether he simply lied about the call from his wife is something we will not know until there's a real investigation into 9/11. In any case, these are some of the things that the 9/11 movement, by getting empirical about 9/11, has discovered, and there is much more. Another issue is why, assuming the truth of the story that the planes were hijacked, the U.S. military failed to intercept them before they could strike their targets. And I believe this is a pretty good time to take a break, just a very brief one. Don't even get up. I'm going to get a glass of water. They've got to change the tape here because my lecture's too long to put on one tape. So they need a moment here.
And while they're changing the tape, I'll tell you that you are listening to Dr. David Ray Griffin speaking on his new book, Debunking 9/11, Debunking. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW,
okay,
Warren.
We'll start this part over again. Another issue is why, assuming the truth of the story that planes were hijacked, the U.S. military failed to intercept them before they could strike their targets. The official story says that it was the FAA's fault. For the first 3 years after 9/11, the military claimed that although the FAA did notify the military about all four flights, these notifications came too late. But the 9/11 truth movement, getting empirical, showed that even if the FAA had been as slow as the military had claimed, there was still time for the interceptions to have been made. This empirical research supported the idea that there had been a stand-down order, canceling standard procedures. However, in the summer of 2004, perhaps in response to these findings, the 9/11 Commission produced a radically different story, saying that the FAA, after notifying the military about the first flight, Flight 11, 9 minutes before it struck the North Tower, did not notify it about the other three flights at all until after they had crashed. The press has repeatedly echoed these claims, not asking if they fit with knowable facts. But a little empirical investigation reveals that they do not. Let's take the claim that the FAA's air traffic controllers did not contact the military about American Flight 11 until 8:38, which was 24 minutes after the controllers had seen the first sign of trouble and 13 minutes after they knew it had been hijacked. There are many reasons to doubt this account. One of these involves a discovery I made while writing 9/11 debunking 9/11 debunking. Generally, I simply report other people's discoveries. But with regard to this issue, I actually did a little empirical work myself. This work involved extended email conversations with two air traffic controllers who have worked at the FAA's Boston Center, which was in charge of Flight 11 when its troubles developed. Robin Horton, who worked there until 1981, and Colin Scoggins, who was and still is the military expert at Boston Center. Between the two of these men, I was provided with most of the new information that my book contains about the planes, about 20 pages worth. So I am very indebted to these two men. Robin Horton, in fact, is here. And Robin, where are you? I'll ask you to stand up. Here he is, right over here. Horton has provided good reason, which is supported by other testimony, to believe that the military was first contacted at 8:20, not 8:38. But I will leave that evidence and the conclusion for you to read in the book. I will here discuss what I learned from Scoggins, whose testimony about another issue plays an important role in the official story, as told by the 9/11 Commission. Scoggins was also interviewed by Michael Bronner for his Vanity Fair article entitled 9/11 Alive, the NORAD Tapes, to which I devote the first chapter of my book. The tapes in question are ones that were used by the 9/11 Commission to construct its new story. The military later gave these tapes to Bronner, who, as one of the producers of the film United 93, which Roland Morgan's book shows to be completely inaccurate, Bronner, as an associate producer, had proved that he was a reliable conveyor of the official story. The fact that Bronner was singled out by the military to receive these tapes means that his article can be considered a semi-official report. And Bronner surely did what the military had hoped, claiming that these tapes present the authentic military history of 9/11. But there are many reasons to doubt this claim. One reason involves the statement made by Bronner and the commission on the basis of these tapes as to when Scoggins first called NEADS, NORAD's Northeast Sector, to report that American Flight 11 appeared to be in trouble. Bronner and the commission claimed that it was not until 8:38. Bronner then says that, according to the tapes, Scoggins reported 2 minutes later at 8:40 that Flight 11 was 35 miles north of Kennedy, now at 367 knots. However, Scoggins told me that although he did make that call, he had reported when he made his first call to NEADS that the flight was 20 miles south of Albany, heading south at a high rate of speed, 600 knots. By the time the plane was 35 miles north of JFK, therefore, it had traveled about 90 miles. If we estimate that the average speed of the plane, which had slowed down during the period from 600 knots to 367 knots, to have been about 500 knots, about 11 minutes would have been needed to cover that distance. Scoggins' first call, accordingly, must have occurred at 8:29, 9 minutes earlier than Bronner and the 9/11 Commission claim, on the basis of the tapes. This would mean that there would have been 18 minutes, not merely 9 minutes, for the military to intercept the flight before it reached Manhattan, easily more than enough time. This is only one of many examples in my book showing that, if we get empirical, we can see that the tapes do not give the authentic military history of 9/11. Another claim made by the 9/11 Commission, then repeated by Bronner, is that there were only two bases in the Northeast Sector of the United States with fighter jets on alert: Otis Air National Guard Base in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and Langley Air Force Base in Langley, Virginia. Bronner, on the basis of this claim, says, referring to Colonel Robert Marr, the head of NEADS, "Incredibly, Marr has only four armed fighters at his disposal to defend about a quarter of the continental United States." Although this claim truly is incredible in the literal sense of that term, it is used by Bronner and the 9/11 Commission to explain why fighters were not immediately put over New York City to protect it, and why fighters to protect Washington, D.C. had to come all the way up from Langley. However, if Bronner and the commission, while interviewing Colin Scoggins, had asked him about this, he could have told them what he told me, that although it is technically correct that Otis and Langley are the only ones in the United States, in that part of the United States that are designated as alert bases, this does not mean that they are the only bases from which NEADS could have drawn fighters that morning. There were ready fighters at Atlantic City, New Jersey, Toledo, Ohio, Syracuse, New York, Burlington, Vermont, and Selfridge, Michigan, as well as Andrews Air Force Base right next to Washington, D.C., on which NEADS could have called. Again, if we get empirical about 9/11, the official story disintegrates.